It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at the Wisconsin roots of legendary actor and director Orson Welles as we mark his 100th birthday this week.
First, if you listen to the governor and other Republicans describe the state budget, there's a lot riding on a new revenue forecast that could come out this week. If the forecast is good, lawmakers could reduce cuts to education and other budget items. If not, the cuts will probably stick.
But critics say it didn't have to be that way, and there are better options going forward if Republicans would take them. WPR's Sean Johnson has this report.
Almost immediately after Governor Scott Walker unveiled his budget in January, Walker and other Republicans were downplaying it. That budget was based on revenue estimates that were too low, they argued. The final budget would have more money to spend once new estimates were in.
Once the new revenue numbers come out.
We'd like to wait for the revenue estimates.
Depending on what the new revenue numbers are. That come
Republicans said that with that new revenue on the way, there was less reason to worry about some of the cuts in Walker's budget. They knew what they'd do with the money once they were sure they had it.
Those levels of funding for schools would be restored.
I think we've agreed to look at K-12 education, transportation, UW, and family care.
I'd like to make sure that we would use a portion of that to help restore some of the money to the university. There are other priorities, too. We still have transportation.
The problem with squeaking by on revenue forecasts is that these days they're increasingly wrong. Brenna Erford worked on a study for Pew Charitable Trust that found that in most states, revenue forecasting errors are bigger than they used to be.
Volatility is really just a fact of life. There's really nothing states can do to get rid of it.
Erford says there are lots of reasons for this. States are susceptible to global economic trends. Also, more tax revenue comes from investment income, which goes up and down. When forecasts predict more revenue, she says states are tempted to use it. That happened in Wisconsin last year when Republicans used a strong revenue estimate to cut taxes. The trouble is, that estimate was wrong. Todd Berry with the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance says the state would have been better off if Walker and lawmakers had done nothing at all.
We'd be sitting on over $1 billion surplus. So that election year decision based on revenue estimates that incidentally turned out to be wrong, to be too high by about $500 million, that decision really, more than anything, set the table for everything that's happened since.
Now that these new estimates are almost here, the governor's tone has changed. He's starting to downplay them, suggesting that if they're not as good as hoped, some budget cuts might be inevitable. That idea bothers John Peacock, budget expert with the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families.
I really can't think of a time when it would be so easy, relatively speaking, to avoid much of the cuts.
For example, Peacock says Republicans could delay the full phase-in of a tax credit they passed for manufacturers that has run into estimate problems of its own. It was originally supposed to cost the state about $100 million this year. Instead, it's cost more than double that.
So rather than continuing to phase that in and having this ballooning cost of a very ineffective tax break for corporations, let's just freeze that in place at the current level.
But Republicans say they like that tax break because they think it will lure manufacturers to Wisconsin. They're more content to take a wait-and-see approach for now. They're also waiting on actual numbers, not estimates, for tax collections this fiscal year. Those need to be good, or Republicans might have to plug a hole in the current budget before they can worry about the next one. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And Sean Johnson is with us now from the Capitol to go a little further into the details. Sean, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So according to Republicans, a lot riding on these numbers. So what have we heard so far about whether the numbers are going to be good or bad?
Well, you've heard I think you can go back to the governor's campaign even, where he was saying these numbers are going to be better than you think. I mean, at that time, every memo that came out seemed to suggest that Wisconsin was going to be facing budget troubles, but the governor was saying that assumes that you're not going to get all this money that I think we're going to get. So the message from Republicans really going back to last fall has been, things are better than you maybe think they're going to be right now. They have one thing working in their favor when it comes to that, and that is they made a lot of changes to the tax law and changes to income tax withholding this year that make it a lot harder to measure than usual. So nobody's quite sure what these numbers are going to show, but either way, there is a lot riding on them.
Right. Well, I was going to ask you, what new information or changes are factored into these new numbers as opposed to the old ones that hopefully will give a more accurate picture?
Yeah, I'd say the biggest one that makes it harder to measure is just with the income tax withholding. And that, you know, that's not a change of how much the state collects in income taxes. It's just a change of when it collects it. So over the past year, after they made that change, you might have noticed that your monthly or, you know, weekly paycheck got a little bit bigger because the state was taking a smaller piece of it in each paycheck. But at the end of the year, if you usually got a refund, that refund got smaller. So it's just a matter of kind of when it takes that money. For revenue forecasters, that makes an already difficult job even more difficult because they can't rely on how things were looking last year at this time or the year before that. Everything is different. And, you know, on top of that, Republicans have added a lot of new tax cuts in recent years. Those are also tough to peg.
So a little clarification here. Mm-hmm. Is this just the latest projection or is this here is what we have, period?
Yeah, it's going to be both. So they do these revenue estimates, you know, every so often to give the state an idea of where things are going, because that's how the state builds its budgets. They look at these estimates and they say, here's how much money we're going to have. Now we have to decide how we're going to spend that. Do we need to cut money? Do we have extra money? What do we want to do with that? It's all based on these. And so we're going to see these estimates coming out for the next couple of years. You know, that will say, do we have any extra money to, you know, plug a hole in the cut to K-12 education? Do we have any extra money to go toward that the University of Wisconsin, which saw a $300 million cut? They're also going to see actual numbers coming out for this fiscal year that say whether or not we need to do something right now because the state's going to run out of money before June 30th.
Now, some critics of the cuts are saying they see some clear options for reducing the proposed budget cuts, including freezing that manufacturing tax credit that's been more expensive than proposed. How receptive are lawmakers to other fixes like that?
Not too receptive, I mean, among majority Republicans, at least not yet. I mean, I think we'll have to see what happens if the numbers come out and they're bad or they're not as good as expected. It might change their view on some things. But as of right now, that tax credit for manufacturers that's costing a lot more than originally projected, Republicans like that. So that's something where Democrats feel like that's an easy fix. That would go ahead and at least freeze that, not roll it back, but just freeze it. Republicans are not talking about that. Another one, which is, you know, just soaked in politics, is that Democrats feel like Republicans ought to accept federal money to expand Medicaid as part of Obamacare. This is something that Republicans in other states have done. So it's not as taboo as it was once seen among GOP leaders. But not in Wisconsin. I mean, Governor Walker said he wants no part of that, even though it could save the state as much as $345 million.
Now, lastly, you said in your piece that the governor seems to be dialing down expectations for these budget projections as a fix for the budget cuts, at least. So what does that say to you about the likelihood of the cuts staying put, more or less?
Well, I'd say, you know, either I would think one of two things is happening there. One, you know, he could be playing an expectations game. Say that it's not looking as good as maybe we thought, or we shouldn't expect these to fix everything. And then if they come out and they're decent, and maybe they even look better than decent. But the other thing is, if anybody has access to these numbers, it'd be the governor. I mean, he can talk to his Department of Revenue, and they can give him an idea of what tax collections looked like in the all-important month of April for the state of Wisconsin. So it could be that he knows something, and he knows that these numbers aren't going to be the silver bullet that everybody thought they were going to be.
Sean, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome.
That was WPR State Capitol reporter Sean Johnson talking about a new state revenue forecast that's expected to come out this week.
But now it's time for Wisconsin Life. May 6th marks the centennial of the birth of acclaimed director and actor and radio guy, Orson Welles. Although his Wisconsin years are often glossed over or left out entirely, writer Dean Robbins reminds us of the way Wisconsin shaped Welles.
People don't associate Orson Welles with Wisconsin. Even biographers gloss over the fact that the brilliant theater, radio, and film artist was born in Kenosha and schooled in Madison. Welles himself played down the association, calling Kenosha a nasty little Middle Western city. But hold on a minute. Wisconsin surely helped to mold this one-of-a-kind virtuoso. He had formative experiences here as a child. Orson Welles is best known for directing highly personal, visually dazzling films like The Magnificent Ambersons and A Touch of Evil. Each one featured his own flamboyant acting. His masterpiece, 1941's Citizen Kane, is usually cited as the greatest movie ever made.
The decent, ordinary citizens know that I'll do everything in my power to protect the underprivileged, the underpaid, and the underfed.
Welles stars as newspaper tycoon Charles Foster Kane, who mysteriously utters, "Rosebud,
Rosebud,"
on his deathbed. In the film's closing seconds, we discover that the word relates to a crucial childhood memory and is the key to Kane's soul. Anyone looking for a Rosebud moment in Welles' own life might focus on the day he attended his beloved mother's funeral in Kenosha at age 9. Given that tragic association, it's no wonder he had mixed feelings about the city of his birth. The world hailed Welles as a prodigy in his early 20s, when he conquered New York theater and terrified the nation with his War of the Worlds radio broadcast.
Strike them head on. Lord, they're turning into flames.
But Wisconsin had recognized his talent long before then. He gained his first public notoriety in the Capital Times when he was all of 10. The newspaper got wind of an extraordinary boy attending elementary school in Madison. It cited his amazing vocabulary and poetic talent, calling him an apparent genius. In the summer after fourth grade, Welles made a big impression at Madison's Camp Indianola. The other campers likely realized he wouldn't be a typical bunkmate when he showed up with his own easel and oil paints. He also told long, dramatic stories during camp meetings, to the point where the counselors tried to shut him up. But Orson would not be denied. He begged to put on a one-man show of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
I will shut it.
Both campers and counselors watched, stunned, as he transformed from one character to another, using vocal inflections and body language.
So I need you. Farewell.
Decades later, an eyewitness still spoke reverently of the astounding summer camp performance. That's how audiences have always felt after experiencing Orson Welles' genius. He later backed off his harsh assessment of Kenosha, calling himself a confirmed badger. I'm thrilled that he considered himself one of us. It makes us automatically essential to the history of 20th century art.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
Here to continue the celebration of Orson Welles' birthday is Norman Gilliland, host and producer of old-time radio drama, among other things, here at WPR. Norman, thanks for joining us.
Well, my pleasure, Rob and Veronica.
So we heard Orson Welles born in Kenosha. Can you talk a little more about how deep his roots were and how mixed his feelings were about Kenosha?
Well, the roots were pretty deep, actually, because he was named after his great-grandfather and his great-grandfather's brother, who had been prominent attorneys in Kenosha in the late 19th century. And of course, his earliest childhood memories would have been of Kenosha. But I don't think you'd even say he was conflicted about Kenosha. I think he didn't, for whatever reason, like Kenosha. And as you heard, he associated it with his mother's funeral, which, of course, was a sad point in his life in 1924. But once, when challenged or requested by a Kenosha congressman to say something nice about the place, he did say something very nice. But Orson Welles was, I think, always on. You know, you could never tell when he was being Orson Welles and when he was being a character, but he could always just make up something that sounded very eloquent, and so he did for Kenosha. But he also said at one point, I was never ashamed of being from the Midwest or from Wisconsin, just Kenosha. You know, so that's why there's not a, that's why there aren't a lot of plaques. You know? Although there is one in front of the house he was born in on 7th Avenue in Kenosha.
I wanted to ask you about that. Let's say you wanted to go on an Orson Welles tour of Wisconsin. Where would you stop?
Some of those landmarks have been lost, like the aforementioned summer camp on the northwest shore of Lake Mendota that he attended in 1925. But the house in Kenosha is still there, 6114 16 7th Avenue. It's a duplex and has been since the early 19th century. It's a charming middle western, middle class house in a modest neighborhood.
You know, I don't know if it's so much Kenosha, I wonder, as in any place Orson Welles, this larger-than-life figure, had been born, he would see himself as too big for it. If it was New York City or Mars or whatever, his birthplace was going to be a place that he had to leave behind.
We'd already rule out Mars because they were the bad guys in War of the Worlds. But, yeah, he was a person who was, as they say, larger than life. And part of what makes it a little complicated to know these stories of his early years is that he was, above all, a storyteller. And that included stories about his own life. He would make stuff up if it sounded really good.
Like what? Sorry.
Well, there is a story about him in summer camp and how one of the adults at that camp put moves on him, and that he fled camp in a canoe across Lake Mendota and wound up in Chicago. But one of his campmates, his actual bunkmate, Lowell Frouch, he said, I think that was just a story he was telling.
Hmm. Wait, can you get from Lake Mendota by canoe to Chicago?
Very gradually.
I don't think so.
It's a long portage, yeah.
Well, you talked about his aptitude for telling stories. Obviously, that's what he's known for, and you brought some along for us to listen to. You got one from the show.
Yeah, the shadow. The thing about the shadow is the plot was the same every week. You know, it was some weird guy who was trying to, like, blow up the whole city or something like that. And the shadow always came in, invisible, and brought him to account. You know, but Orson Welles, brilliant actor that he was, could make it work every week because he had such intensity as the shadow.
Now, here's what I want you to do. Keep quiet and watch your chance. Then I want you to cry out that shadow could solve this crime without half trying.
Aren't you flattering yourself?
Never mind that, Margot. I have a very definite reason for doing this. A lot depends on your getting the crowd to take up your suggestion.
I'll do my best, Lamont. But where are you going?
I won't be far away. Hand me that leather case on the floor.
Right. Here you are. Am I permitted enough womanly curiosity to ask what's in it?
Just a little wiretapping device.
Telephone?
No. Now, Commissioner Weston will be talking over the loudspeaker system in Midtown Hall. Don't be surprised if the shadow interrupts his speech. Now, remember, Margot, cry out at the psychological moment. Hundreds of lives depend on it.
All right, well, not exactly at the forefront of the women's rights movement there, but Margot was a good sidekick, I guess.
Well, yeah, in fact, and we could maybe get to her if time permits, but that was another sort of Wisconsinite, Agnes Moorhead, who worked in Reedsburg and went to the UW-Madison, got a master's degree here.
Talk a little more about Orson Welles on the radio. You, of all people, are very familiar with The Shadow and Orson Welles' radio work.
There was nobody better. That's all there is to it. Nobody more versatile. I remember 20 years ago or so, I interviewed Steve Allen, who was very versatile in his own right, and he said as a young radio actor, he put on his best Orson Welles voice, you know, as everybody else did. He just made it sound as if that was a given. But what Orson Welles had, and at a very early age, we have to remember 1938, War of the Worlds. He was already world famous before that, but even more so after, 23 years old. And he's doing this because he has this commanding voice. He has this ability to grasp any character on the page and make it all work. He could do multiple characters in the same show, narrator, main character, minor character, and he could do the same character over a certain period of time as he did in the radio version of The Magnificent Amberson. So he was playing a 17-year-old, then 20 years later, the same character, older, different voice, different persona even. He just had all the parts. The parts he didn't have, by the way, later on, he wasn't a great businessman, and he was also lousy as a diplomat when it came to business dealings.
Hmm. How did he
come by, you know, this skill as an actor? Was he trained, or is this something he was just born with?
He's mostly born with it. Although later in life, of course, he did get some, I guess, tutoring, but mostly it was just a matter of seeing it and doing it. And, I mean, he just had this incredible innate talent.
We're talking about his Wisconsin connection now, but do you think, in general, Wisconsin has paid enough attention to his Wisconsin roots, his Kenosha and Madison roots?
Well, you know, I think he was, let's say, a Midwesterner, mm-hmm. Because, again, if you look at, something like Citizen Kane and the whole Rosebud thing. Okay, what's that about? It's about an idyllic life in the West or the Midwest. And Orson Welles, I think, had a bit of that Rosebud in him. You know, he did, I think, consider himself a Midwesterner, although primarily, if you asked him where was home, he would have said Woodstock, Illinois, where he went to this formative boys' school for several years.
Well, Norman, thanks a lot for joining us and celebrating his 100th birthday.
My pleasure, Veronica. Rob?
That was Norman Gilliland, who's been the host and producer of old-time radio drama for 25 years. It airs each Saturday and Sunday night from 8 to 11 on the Ideas Network.
Time takes away, so the story is told. I've asked so many questions of the wise men I met.
There are 1.5 million black men missing from daily life in the United States, in large part because of incarceration and early death. That's the conclusion of a new analysis of census data from the New York Times.
That means that nationwide, for every 100 black women in daily life, there are only 83 black men. Meanwhile, almost no gap for white men and women, with 99 white men for every 100 white women.
And the absence of black men is much more pronounced in certain areas of the country than others. One of those places is in Wisconsin's largest city. There are 14,000 black men missing from daily life in Milwaukee. Men only account for 42% of the city's black population of about 24,000, 240,000, rather.
Right now, we're joined by the author of the New York Times analysis, Justin Wolfers. He's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and a professor of economics and public policy at the University of Michigan. Later, we'll take a closer look at Milwaukee, specifically with the director of the Institute for Intercultural Research at UW-Milwaukee. Justin Wolfers, welcome to Central Time.
A pleasure to be here, Rob.
So what does this mean? We gave some of the basics there, that 1.5 million black men are missing from daily life.
So every 10 years, the Census Bureau goes out and counts how many people they find in houses around the country. And they found, we're looking at prime age people, age 25 to 54, and among African Americans, they found 1.5 million fewer men than women. We know where some of them are. About 600,000 of them are in prison, obviously not a part of their communities. And then there's something of a puzzle as to where the rest are. Now, we also know some number of them are died early. This is a cohort who lived through the, many didn't live through the HIV epidemic, which had a particularly strong impact on the black population, and particularly among black men. And also this group who, for whom homicide rates are incredibly high. It's a big part of, I think, the mortality story here. The homicide rate has fallen a bit over the past decade or so, but still it's something that has a very disproportionate effect on African-American men.
And so whatever the cause is, if we go to communities today, there are often substantially more black women in that age range than black men.
Yeah, and I think the consequences of this are absolutely fascinating, which is how is it these communities adapt? So, you know, it's not just the men who are in prison or who died early who suffer as a result of this. There are whole communities left behind that are changed. For many women, this probably means that if they're looking to partner within their community and within their racial or ethnic group, they're not finding a lot of partners. And we do see a lot of women instead striking out alone. Starting their own household without a partner, often having children nonetheless. For the men who are left behind in the communities, you look at a city like Ferguson, there are, for every 100 black women, there are 60 black men, the most imbalanced city, large city in the country. And you think about how that must reshape life for both men and women in a community like that.
You mentioned Ferguson as a pocket. Are there a lot of pockets in the country where this imbalance is particularly striking?
You know, across the country, for every 100 black women, there's only 83 black men, which sort of says that just about everywhere you look, it's pretty darn striking. I mean, that in itself is an amazing statistic. There are parts of the country where there's no such imbalance. So if you head to the West Coast, in fact, you see basically parity and sometimes even a few more African-American men than women. The areas where we see the greatest imbalance, the South, people may not be surprised to hear that, the Midwest, and also the big urban centers in the Northeast.
You mentioned the difference in California. Is there some internal migration? Is that part of the story here? Is that part maybe of the missing number?
The truth is we're not really sure. It's easy enough to figure out, and when I say it's easy enough, it actually turns out to be quite difficult, but it's easy enough to figure out where these men are missing. Trying to figure out a precise story as to why is a lot harder. I have hypotheses. I'm sure you do, and I'm sure your listeners do too. But I wouldn't want to suggest I've got any great confidence as to what's going on.
Well, is there a next step in research then, where we try to figure out more thoroughly the causes for this this distinction, this difference?
I think the two important consequences for research are exactly as you say, figuring out the cause, and obviously one big part of it is the mass incarceration of African American men. Another big part has something to do with the very grim circumstances that a lot of families find themselves in when they're in urban poverty. But also trying to think about what the consequences of this are. For instance, there's a lot of talk about, particularly among conservatives, about problems with the African-American family, and there's not a lot of marrying going on. Well, you know what? If there's not a lot of fellas, that might explain why there's not a lot of marrying going on. And I suspect that there's quite a lot that we see that may be explained by this rather remarkable demographic imbalance.
Talking to Justin Wolfers of the University of Michigan about his census data analysis, finding 1.5 million black men missing in the country for reasons including mortality rates, incarceration rates, and some mysteries along the way there. Justin, let's get in some more to the consequences. And you mentioned the marriage and dating market and what that's doing to families. So what does that look like from the perspective of the women and men? Get into that a little more, if you would, please.
Sure. Let's go to a town like Ferguson. Think about 100 women, and there's 60 men. Well, it may be that 20 of the women have married 20 of the men. So then we're left with 80 women, 80 single women, and 40 single men. That's an unbelievable ratio. It's going to have a ton of effects. So for one of the reasons, think about standard markers of success, things like getting a job. One of the reasons that we go out and hit these standard markers of success, and here I'm channeling Kerwin Charles, who's an excellent economist on this at the University of Chicago, is that it helps us find a mate. But for the men in Ferguson, there's no such market pressure. In fact, they're scarce. They could find another girlfriend tomorrow. And so there's the possibility that, in fact, this helps explain why some groups of men are less engaged in the labor force or are leading less conventional lives and not ticking off the traditional markers of success. They don't really need to in order to be attractive on the marriage market.
Well, then let's look to the next generation. Do you look at, say, young black men being raised in these communities where there's this huge gap? Is that something we should be looking at when we're trying to evaluate the consequences?
For sure, there's a lot of concern out there about the consequences of fatherlessness or about not having a father present. And that certainly is overwhelming. It's a very important trend in many of these communities where, you know, if many of the prime-aged men are in prison, many of them are the dads as well. You know, we need to be a little bit careful here. It's not necessarily the case that that family would be better off if they forced dad to go back and live with mum. Dad may well be in prison for a range of reasons, some of which maybe wouldn't make him an ideal father figure. So I think what we have is, it's not necessarily that you want to push couples back together. My guess is mum is probably making some pretty good choices given the circumstances she's in. Maybe you want to think about what those circumstances are instead. But there is generally, I think, there is this shortage of father figures, and the consequences of that for definitions of masculinity and for the types of life choices those kids make, I think, are potentially quite important.
Right, even if we're not talking about a father per se, father figures or mentors or role models in a community, much less the family.
Absolutely.
So other consequences, I think you pointed to in your research, that's a lot of voters not present in a community.
Yes, it's the men who are in jail, of course, if it's a felony, they're not voting again. So it's not just they're not voting while they're in prison, they're not voting when they get out. The men who have died, of course, they're not voting. And so it actually turns out to be a substantial reduction in the number of African Americans who are eligible to vote. And then there's a rich irony in all of this, which is if you put a prison in a community, we actually count all the prisoners as living in that community. And that counts for congressional apportionment, which means that if you happen to live in a community that has a prison, there'll be a smallish number of free citizens and a relatively large number of incarcerated people who make up the electorate, and of course those in jail can't vote. And so it actually distorts our democracy as well.
So this distinction we're talking about, the missing black men in communities, is this something new in recent census evidence, or is this something that has roots deeper back in time?
It has much deeper roots. You know, it's something that when we discovered, the New York Times ran it in the front page of the newspaper, but there's no sense in which this is news. The rough proportions of missing men have been about the same now for 50 years. Now, what underlay that was different. So today it's largely driven, or a large part of it reflects incarceration and the incarceration boom. You go back 50 years ago, that was before the incarceration boom. And so a lot more of it back then was likely mortality. So the depressing way of saying this is that life got somewhat better for African-American men over the last 50 years in the sense that their higher death rates normalized a little bit, but all of those gains were offset by higher incarceration rates instead.
Justin, thanks for joining us today.
A pleasure.
That's Justin Wolfers, senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He did a census data analysis for the New York Times, concluding that there are 1.5 million black men missing from daily life in the United States.
We just spoke with an economist who analyzed census data to find that mainly due to incarceration and early death, there are 1.5 million black men missing from daily life in the United States. That means that for every 100 black women, there are only 83 black men.
Closer to home, according to that same data, Milwaukee is one of the U.S. cities with the largest number of missing black men at 14,000. That means only 42% of Milwaukee's black population, of about 240,000 people, are men. Here with us now to talk about how that affects Milwaukee's communities is Gary Williams. He's an associate professor of educational policy and community studies at UW-Milwaukee, and he's director of the Institute for Intercultural Research. Gary, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So we just heard some general numbers around the country. How does this absence, these missing men, how does this affect Milwaukee communities?
Well, in several different areas, a couple of which your previous speaker alluded to, voting. One area that your previous speaker made reference of, those 14,000 could swing a vote, and that's critically important to them being absent from the community. You're talking about employment. Again, 14,000 men who are not part of the workforce and contributing and paying taxes and paying the cost of education for themselves and their children. Role models in the community, again, they're absent. They're not there, whether they're part of a family or role models who support children and other members of our community. So there are several areas that are critically important to this number of 14,000 missing from Milwaukee.
Let's pick up that point of role models. You work with a mentoring program for African-American boys in Milwaukee. When you talk to them about their families, their support systems, how often are men missing from the picture?
Men are missing more often than we would like, especially positive male role models in their lives. And that's where the mentoring program is important. We have a tiered mentoring program that we've proposed putting in place, and it includes African-American alums of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, for example, working with college African-American males, and those college students in turn working with the K-12 population of African-American males. So it's tiered, and at each tier, we provide models for the next level.
Do you have a story from the kids that you've worked with in this program about how this can impact their lives?
Oh, absolutely. These kids are real clear about their needs. A couple of years ago, we talked with a group of them and asked point blank, what do you need from us? What would it take to ensure your success? And those kids mentioned to us, and these were kids from elementary through seniors in high school, they made it clear that parenting was important to them, that individuals from the black community, as they said, stepping up and supporting them was important. Jobs and education, all these things were important to these kids.
So these numbers we're talking about, missing black men, 14,000 fewer black men than women, I gather. This is a big difference, but are people conscious of this in their daily lives, or is this just part of the scenery?
I think they're very conscious of it, and as a result of that, you see efforts devoted towards trying to turn that around. You talk about organizations like the Social Development Commission and social organizations like 100 Black Men and Running Rebels, and they serve different populations. Social Development Commission working with people in poverty, 100 Black Men mentoring black men, black males, and then, of course, a program like Running Rebels for Youth. So they're all well aware of this problem and working together in order to address it.
Now, what about the economy as part of the problem here? Are there enough jobs, if we had all these men in the community, are there enough jobs to keep them there?
There are jobs that may not necessarily be in Milwaukee, in the city of Milwaukee. The jobs tend to be in the outlying areas. So, of course, transportation becomes an issue. And then that creates a whole set of problems because the poor public transportation system in the city of Milwaukee will not get them to the jobs in the suburbs and in Waukesha County and other places. Some of these individuals, because of their past records, may not have driver's license. Again, access to those jobs. And then, of course, income, not having the financial resources to purchase a vehicle, let alone provide maintenance on a vehicle. So there are a lot of problems, many of which could be addressed by creating more jobs and opportunities, as well as providing training and education for those black males.
We're talking to Gary Williams from the UW-Milwaukee, looking at some national census data showing missing black men, 1.5 million nationwide, a shortage of them, many incarcerated, some because of early mortality rates, some, as our previous guest said, it's still a mystery. Focusing on Milwaukee, the largest number of these missing black men at about 14,000, talking about the causes and consequences of that. Gary, I wanted to look at how this might look to women in Milwaukee's black communities. How does this affect their lives?
Well, this is an age-old problem in Milwaukee, and I'm sure in other cities. The disproportionate number of, for example, you talk about a university college women who anticipate graduating and moving on with their lives and not finding mates at that level. And so this is something we've known about for some time. It has not created a problem in terms of those women crossing the racial ethnic line in order to marry, intermarrying. So that's one solution. There are others who, in this generation of women, are holding off on marriage till later on in life. And as we know, and this is where some people seem to be confused, there are black men in college. Half of black men do go to college. The problem is many of them are not graduating at a rate comparable to black women. So there's some of this that we've been aware of for some time and have addressed in various ways.
Well, we touched a little bit on part of the solutions you're working on, mentoring for younger black men, for black boys who don't have the role models. Are there solutions to evening out these numbers, to keeping black men in their community? What would you like to see change?
Well, again, I go back to jobs and education. I go back to job creation, job training, and education as a key to employing these individuals, dissuading them from other avenues that might lead to incarceration or death. I think that the employment is critically important. And this is not new. The county, the city must work together in order to create jobs, provide training, and educate black males.
Now, we've seen an outbreak of gun violence in Milwaukee this year, actually. We've talked about that a fair amount on the show, including with Mayor Barrett. Is this part of the problem, trying to prevent this kind of violent crime in the city? And I know it's a huge question, but what do you think needs to be done to tackle that?
Well, part of the problem is poverty. When you have people in impoverished situations like this, you get this aberrant behavior on their part. And the problem is that many of them feel that they've lost hope. And are striking out sometimes against other individuals and sometimes other individuals like themselves and sometimes other individuals against them. But I don't want to get into a situation where we think this is unique to the black community, because you also have the European American or white community with white on white crime is around 80%, black on black crime is about 90%. And so it exists where there are other economic related issues, and many of them have to do with jobs and education.
Are there things you'd like to see in the justice system at the local, state, even federal level to try to keep people from ending up incarcerated for longer periods of time?
Oh, absolutely. More diversion projects that keep them out of the system and keep them productive and working, even if they have to be monitored somehow while in the community. I think what you see happening in the criminal justice system and correction system is this bipartisan initiative to reform the correction system. And I think they're right on the money in doing that. And our own, the DA's office here in Milwaukee is working on that as well. So continuing to move down that road and decriminalizing some of these offenses, misdemeanors and things like that, and as opposed to incarcerating. It costs more to incarcerate these people than educate them. So let's do something differently, and diversion is one of those policies or practices. And that's where we have to go with this. You've got to look at the policies and practices that result in these disproportionate numbers of people of color incarcerated.
So these numbers we're looking at are striking, depressing in some ways. Do you see signs of hope? Do you see things happening that you think are going to turn this around in the next 10 years, generation or two?
I think it's going to turn around in the next 5 years, actually, if, in fact, we continue down this road of reforming corrections and acknowledging the fact that job creation, job training, and education are going to be important to many of these communities. As you've seen communities around the country over the last few months just explode behind incidents involving black males, and the officials in those communities try to address this by talking about issues of education and job creation and employment as a solution to part of the problem, because it lifts people out of poverty and that impoverished state of mind.
If someone's out there thinking related to the mentor programs you talked about earlier, hey, maybe that's me, maybe I could be that mentor. Who do they reach out to? How do they get involved?
I think there are a couple of areas for this. As I mentioned, 100 black men have been doing this for some time. That's one organization that I would reach out to immediately. Others, Running Rebels deals more with youth, and there are folks in that organization who would welcome mentors. The initiatives that are currently underway at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, we're in the process of putting something together that would involve all black men in Milwaukee, regardless of age. And mentors, when we talk about mentors, we're not simply saying that black men are the only ones who are able to mentor or black boys. We're saying people who are interested in looking at the improving the quality of life and the success of black males are in a position to act as mentors.
Gary, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Gary Williams, Associate Professor of Educational Policy and Community Studies at UW-Milwaukee.
Coming up, we'll talk to the Executive Director of the Sixth Amendment Center about their new study on court-appointed attorney compensation in Wisconsin.